and Hound podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Horse and Hound podcast in partnership this month with Charles Owen. I'm Pippa Room, magazine editor here at Horse and Hound. I hope everyone's well and not completely washed away by this very wet spring. We're all really hoping for some drier weather in April. I'm delighted this month to introduce you to Horse and Hound's new dressage editor. Oscar Williams joined us in the autumn last year, and this is his first appearance on our podcast. On this episode, Oscar speaks to British dressage Olympian Richard Davison, who talks about Britain's chances at Paris 2024 this summer and why he loves the sport. So with no further ado, let's hear from Richard.
Hello, I'm Oscar Williams, the dressage editor here at Horse and Hound, and I'm delighted to be joined on the podcast today by Richard Davison. Richard is a four-time Olympian and multi-medaled rider who has been at the forefront of British dressage for almost four decades. Richard, great to have you on. Whereabouts in the country do we find you today?
Well, thanks, Oscar, and hello, podcast listeners. And actually, you find me. I've just screeched into my office in the stables. I've literally just got off a horse. And I have to say, I was very thankful for your nice introduction, Oscar, because it gave me a chance to get my breath back. And hopefully I've got it back now. And I've just been handed a nice cup of coffee, so I'm all yours. So shall we get started?
Sounds perfect, Richard. Let's crack on then. You've been involved in the development of Britain's rise onto the medal podium. Carl Hester even credits you with being the mastermind behind Britain's first gold medal in 2012. What do you attribute this success to? And do you think it's sustainable in the future?
Wow. Well, first of all, it's very nice to be credited like that. I don't think I was the mastermind. There are lots of people involved. But yes, good question. And I have to go back in my mind and memory, which is always difficult, to probably 1993 when we won our first team medal at the European Championships. And I was lucky enough to be part of that team. Actually, with Lottie Fry's mother, I must say, as well as Emil Fowry and Ferdy Arlberg. And that really got the nation, if you like, or the dressage community fired up because we realised we had come a long way and we could win team medals. But, you know, I think I get asked this question a lot, you know, what factors are there behind seemingly endless medal tally that we reach now. And I think there are four factors, really. First of all, we've learned to choose a better type of horse, the right type of horse that has potential for international Grand Prix and that has the qualities and the mindset. So I think we're much better at choosing our horses. We learned how to ride and train them and optimize each horse as an individual. We learnt how to manage them better, keep them sound, travel them better. And of course, you know, what we've always been good at in the UK is the all-important downtime in the field. But what I mean by that management, I'm including the shoeing, the saddle fitting and all of that, because it all has an influence on performance. And lastly, and I think very importantly, how to attract and keep owners. And that's been that's what we've learned really over the decades since we won our first team medal. It's taken a long time to learn it and to get it right, but I think we're on a really good pathway now.
Super. And I know you've been very successful in attracting commercial sponsorship and keeping owners. What advice would you give to younger riders looking to do the same?
Yes, I have been lucky. I was sponsored by Hiscox Insurance for 15 years, and we've partnered lots of our current partners for a very long time. For example, Dodson and Horrell, who feed and fuel our horses. We've been with for almost 40 years now, Wow Saddlery, similar. So I won't list them all, but it's about longevity. And the basis of the products and the partners, sponsors that we work with is that all the products that we use here on our horses are not chosen on a commercial deal. In other words, what a company might offer me to use the product. They're absolutely chosen because we believe these products are the best for our horses. the value of our horses, both in monetary terms and just in our the value to us, is something money can't buy. So when you walk into my stables, you will find the products that we publicly endorse are exactly the ones that we use. So I think that what advice would I give to riders but seeking sponsorship is that I think that they should think when they're discussing with a company or a business, what can they do for the product, for the business? How can they assist in sales, product development? It's not just about product awareness. Actually, you know, that's quite easy now with social media being what it is. But as a sponsored rider, I believe that you have to contribute in commercial terms more than the cost of you to the business. And in that way, the business feels not that it's a win-win, but they're getting value for money. And I don't think that you should ever look on it like you're expecting a business to be a charity or a benefactor for you. I think you've got to be part of that business. And the same principle applies to the owners. I've been lucky enough to have only a very few owners over 30 to 40 years. And I have to say, we've been very aligned in our interests. But I've been very mindful of what their needs and their priorities are. And strangely enough, it isn't all about, or it isn't solely about winning or being successful. The owners I've been lucky enough to have a relationship with and own and ride horses for have much wider values than just the success. For example, I mean, they're a very high-powered bunch, you know, Lord and Lady Bamford, the Countess of Derby and the Earl of Derby. That was the horse that I rode for them in the London Olympics. And then Gwendolyn Sontheim in the US is a show jumper in the US, but an heir to one of the biggest companies in the US. And frankly, I enjoy learning as much about their experiences as I hope they do. But you've got to identify the values of your owners and they've got to align with your own. And then you can have a long-term relationship. You've got to be very open about what's happening with the horses, everything. I know some riders are nervous to share the bad times horses go through, but it's really important to share those. A lot of the owners that I've just mentioned and others have actually helped me resolve problems and issues because of the way they think. So basically, make the journey enjoyable and fulfilling for them and keep them a very big part of that journey.
Sound advice. Now, Richard, as well as being involved at the highest level of sport, you're also a trustee of World Horse Welfare. What are your views on the recent welfare scandals, not just in dressage, of course, but across all the disciplines?
Yes. Well, I very much enjoy being a trustee of World Horse Welfare. As you know, it's a global charity and, you know, it covers not just horses in equestrian sport, but horses and donkeys and ponies used for work and industry in some of the poorest geographical areas in the world. So we see some very tragic and sad cases. But I think that does open your eyes, or certainly I found this as a trustee, to get the full spectrum of the horse-human interaction and how that can sometimes go adrift and go wrong. But as for neglect and abuse caused by, you know, solely intentional cruelty, it's actually a very, very small percentage of the welfare cases that get referred to World Horse Welfare. Mostly it's all caused by unintentional or lack of competence or knowledge. And I think that transfers exactly to the situation that we are seeing, the recent ones that have hit the headlines in terms of equestrian sport. It's misguided, and riders still think that forceful methods are going to get them where they want. And the fact of the matter it is, they're not effective training methods. They won't get you where you want. And obviously they're plainly wrong. But it is a question of, you know, getting that message over and educating people. I've never come across anybody that has set out, that keeps horses, that wants to set out to be intentionally cruel. And I don't suppose any of us on listening to this podcast or any members of the National Federations set out to be intentionally cruel. But, you know, can we ride better? Can we train better? Can we learn more about the more ethical ways to help horses learn? Yes, we can. And that's what we've got to do. But I just want to get it in proportion, because if I've been thinking recently, if you take the number of starts and competitions that's maybe happened over this last weekend or in the last year in all equestrian disciplines, from eventing to vaulting to reining to everything, and you think how many cases of welfare cases or abuse cases there are, it is a minute proportion of cases, of examples. And I sometimes think this gets out of proportion and out of scale, and I don't think it's always balanced. And I'd like to propose that we are all provided with this balance and reminded of it. I think that's the job. I think our national federations, the International Federation, the FAI, could be better at providing those facts. And I think, you know, so too, I realise in the media that, you know, bad news makes good headlines and sells. But I do think this sense of balance and proportionality could be cited much more often, so we all keep a handle on that. You know, I think it's completely right that people are sanctioned and punished if they step over the line. That's the whole point why we have rules and we have national laws, which, you know, should be and are used and might be used in some of these cases that you've read about. But I do think that, you know, I am a believer in natural justice, and whether that's governing bodies, sporting governing bodies, investigating cases and obviously suspending riders while they investigate, or whether it is law enforcement investigating, it all takes time. And I think, well, while that investigation is going on, we should just remain calm, get on with our looking at our own standards of riding and managing horses, and let those investigations take their course and the outcome be whatever it is.
Okay. More with Richard Davison in just a second. Let's take a quick break.
This month's Horse and Hound podcast is brought to you in partnership with Charles Owen. Charles Owen has long been a name synonymous with safety and research in the equestrian industry. Made in Britain, Charles Owen helmets are sought after around the world in every equestrian discipline. 95% of their helmets hold three equestrian standards or more, including British PASS 015 standard.
Richard Davison is our guest on the podcast this month. Richard, on another, but I guess related note, I noticed you've become very active on Instagram recently, and I was wondering what you thought about all the reaction to the FEI's new social media guidelines.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm very pleased you have noticed. Yes, I have. I've taken to Instagram. So please follow me at Davison Equestrian. Yes, I have. What do I think about the social media guidelines? Well, what I think is that this is a bit unfortunate timing to focus on them, because I think it got the wrong message out there. These guidelines and these rules actually are not new, but it was just unfortunate when we had, you know, a couple of cases hitting the headlines. And I think a lot of people interpreted these guidelines were trying to cover up, censor, and be the opposite to transparency. Now, the FEI have made it very clear, because of their statement, that that's not the intention of these guidelines at all. I mean, if you work it out, it's purely an economic purpose, and it's not unusual. Lots of sports also have similar policies and guidelines. If you think about it, it's just about broadcast revenue and broadcast costs. There's a cost. We all love watching live streams or when it's on the mainstream TV, but there's a cost to that. And organising committees in the FEI have somehow got to offset that cost. And one of the ways they do it is to, I mean, no broadcaster is going to be interested in signing a deal if your hundreds of thousands of people are going to be getting on the internet free broadcast, free video, free footage of what they're just about to package up and send out. So, you know, you can completely understand the commercial reasons behind it. It was, as I said, just very unfortunate. But there is one side of those guidelines that bothers me the most. And it's not actually about the rights that riders are restricted to. It's that if you look at those guidelines, while us riders can publish on social media, can film actually and publish our own rounds, our own performances, provided we get the footage from the FEI, but that's not such a big deal. Owners are expected to surrender all of their rights of their horses. So they own the property and they own these horses, which are hugely valuable. And some of these owners are commercial businesses. So actually their own social media channels are really important to the running of the success of their businesses. And for the FEI and the National Federations to approve that these owners are absolutely not allowed even the same rights as riders, I think is absolutely counterproductive and wrong. And I suggest that the FEI and the National Federations implement a rule change for that straight away. Because if you work it out, if these owners and the owners of the horses win world championships and all the rest of it, if they said, well, actually, we find your rules are too onerous and not in proportion and not necessary compared to what riders can do. So we won't let our horses go in there. There'll be nothing to film and there'll be nothing to ride, nothing to film, and nobody will be making any money from the broadcast. So I think that's a bit of an oversight in the guidelines.
Indeed. And sticking with the rule changes then, what do you think about the way equipment rule changes are being changed on the national and international level?
So the rule changes, yes, both for tack and equipment. First of all, at an FEI level, which often feeds down to the National Federation. So the regulations that you get when you compete nationally are mostly mirroring the FEI. So it's very important what the FEI permit and prohibit. But those that you have to understand how rules and regulations are approved or not approved at the FEI. There are, I don't know the latest tally, but around 123 national federations, and all have an equal vote. And at the General Assembly, although the FEI try to really present these things as simply and the best that they can, if you bear in mind all of the FEI disciplines and all of the federations that are expected to vote and understand the ins and outs of these equipment and the effects of this equipment on the horses, It's, to be honest, it's very hit and miss, and it shouldn't be hit and miss. I don't think it's actually the current system is particularly working. The FEI have tried to have a more systematic approach to this, but I don't think they're always looking on this as an evidence-based process. So the science behind why certain bits are approved or not approved and the reasons isn't published by the FEI. And, you know, I think there's a lack of transparency there. And even if the science isn't complete or fully robust, let us know what the reasoning is. And I've been part of these groups, you know, over the years of different types of equipment groups for the FEI, and sitting around an office table deciding, trying to guess how the pressures of a bit work is a very inefficient process. So I think they need to rethink it. I think they need to open the doors, be more transparent about the actual expert advice that is dictating these bit noseband pressures, boot pressures, anything really. And I don't think one person can be an expert on all of those. Obviously not, because a lot of it is about pressure exerted on a horse. Well, that's a sort of physics-based exercise. I don't mean entirely physics-based, but that's part of it. But I think we have to go and seek the input of experts and base it on reliable or as reliable evidence as we've got currently. You know, I think I was listening to the International Jumping Riders Club, AGM, in Geneva, and that's online if anybody wants to listen to it. And you could see that the FEI Equipment Act, TAC Act, which was meant to assist everybody, and it's a really good idea in principle, but it's actually causing more confusion than it's achieving clarity. So we need a rethink, but we need to do it transparently, and we need proper experts in the various bits of equipment.
So Richard, we've heard how busy you are across many aspects of equestrianism. Can you tell us what this year has in store for you, and can you describe what an average week might look like for you?
There isn't an average week. every day is different. I have got a busy year ahead. I've got a busy week ahead. I'm just starting out an up-and-coming international Grand Prix horse who's done his first international competition. I'm a bit of a fact-finding mission there, but I'm really enjoying developing him. And so obviously, you know, I'll still be competing internationally with him. We've also got some really promising young horses, including our show jumpers here, which we have more show jumpers than dressage horses. So of course, the daily training is really important to fit, that I find time to fit in with them. And obviously, this is an important year for some of my pupils, you know, in their quest for Olympic selection. And I have to find time for that. And then I've got lots of other meetings, reports to do, for instance, you know, the London International Horse Show or Royal Windsor Horse Show, which I'm involved in the organising committees. And then I support other shows, for instance, Bolesworth and Ling, as well as. So I've just agreed to be, and I'm enjoying being a trustee of the British Horse Foundation. And actually, as soon as we've finished this podcast, I've got to rush off to chair a coaches advisory group for the BHS. So, you know, there's plenty of things that sort of keep me out of mischief. But I also want to allow time for a bit of mischief and a bit of fun, because I think you need a bit of that. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that too.
Awesome. And what do you think about the future of dressage in general? Is it a positive one?
I think it's absolutely, I think it's really exciting. And I don't let, you know, this small percentage of people that have crossed over the line spoil it. You know, dressage is about training horses. So if you like riding horses and like training them actually from the ground or the saddle, it doesn't make any difference, then you like dressage. You don't need to compete to enjoy dressage, but if you do compete, then I think you've got to do it for the right reasons. It's not all about winning prizes. It's about satisfaction that you get from the relationship with a horse in the stable and in the saddle. And I mean, that's why I love doing it. And that's why I don't intend to retire. I mean, and there might be a point that the public can't bear to see me anymore in competitions, but I like riding horses and training horses. And I mean, I think I'm so lucky, and we're all so lucky, all of us, you know, that has been our path that we've been able to follow.
And Richard, just looking ahead to the Summer Olympics, do we think it'll prove to be a successful one for Team GB?
So this year's Olympics will be a successful one. I am very confident saying that we are going to get medals in every discipline, and the Paralympics, of course, as well. But now going further, I'm really reluctant to start giving you the colour of those medals, because I'm just a bit superstitious about the commentator's curse. So I don't want it to go wrong. But if you promise not to tell anybody, we're definitely going to win team gold in dressage, same in show jumping and eventing. But that's just between us.
That's lovely. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's been so enlightening and positive to talk all things dressage. Thank you so much, Richard.
Well, no, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you to Oscar and Richard for joining us today on this episode of the Horse and Hound podcast in partnership with Charles Owen. Next month, we'll be bringing you an interview with one of our top showing personalities. So make sure you check back at the end of April for that. In the meantime, do let your friends know about the Horse and Hound podcast so they can join the fun. Talk to you soon. The Horse and Hound podcast is a Media Cage production.